accession number 17268, Reel 1.
Before telling my stories, I think I'll first of all tell you a little about myself. My name is Sydney England. I was born in Birmingham in the year 1915, so I'm now coming up to 81 years of age. In my years, of course, I have seen several wars, having been born during the First World War, of which I have very little memory other than seeing a German Zeppelin coming over Birmingham on its way to drop bombs at a small place called Pelsall, near Walsall in Staffordshire. And of course I do have a faint memory also of the peacetime celebrations. Normal schooling, and started work of course at the age of 14, as most boys did, other than grammar school boys in those days. In 1935 I did join another company who were manufacturers of car parts or vehicle parts, both private cars and commercial vehicles. That was in late in 1935. By 1937 the government has started to take note of the warnings given by Winston Churchill of possible wars in the future, and consequently the treasurer, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, opened his purse and orders started coming from to us from Ministry of Defence, the Ministry of Production as it was then, and the RAF, buying department for various equipment. In 1935, when I started the firm, there were 25 people. By the time I did get called into the army, we were employing 150, and of course by then it was all on war work. I was, my job was that of production manager, and I was responsible for getting the work all laid on and produced. By 1938-1939 we were making hundreds of parts for Bren gun carriers, for people like Ford Motors, and in fact all the vehicle producers were taking Bren gun carrier parts from us. So eventually when during training I started driving as part of the training a track vehicle. The first track vehicle was a Bren gun carrier, so I knew a lot of the parts that were then on that machine. With the British Army losing literally thousands of men at Dunkirk, so many, many tens of thousands in there, fighting up and down the desert on several occasions under the various generals, the army was short, and they altered the scope of reserved occupations. Mine as production manager was originally 25 years of age, but to cover the shortage of men, things were upped, so the age became 30. Now, me being under that age, I then had to, I was conscripted. I joined the 52nd Training Regiment of the RAC at Warminster in Wiltshire, in March 42, and with the normal basic training, drilling and all the rest of it that that goes with basic training, but we were under, I'm pleased to say, under a very, very good drill sergeant, Bill Hester. He was a guardsman, but at the same time he was a good instructor and tried to teach us teamwork. And with 36 in the squad, I think eventually Bill Hester taught us all to pull our weight, especially by the time it was passing out parade after our initial 6 weeks training. During that 6 week training, of course, we were taught pistol shooting, rifle shooting, brand gun shooting, and tommy gun shooting. And it was there in my fourth week in the army that I came acquainted with death by guns. We were on the shooting range, and the usual drill was, if there was a stoppage, shout stoppage, and of course everyone stopped firing. But some of them, one of the troopers had trouble with a tommy gun. We all stopped, and the captain in charge then started to dismantle the tommy gun. And it's apparently, if I remember rightly, three-piece effort. Somewhere or another, the pistol group, I think it was called, he could not unlock. We were standing around, five or six of us standing around watching him, and to release it, this captain, he put the stun gun on the ground and brought his foot up and with his heel kicked the pistol group to get it separated from the stock. And of course there must have been a bullet in the breech, which had caused the one that which caused the stoppage, which of course that fired, and of course went straight through the chest of the captain who was bending over it, of course, to kick it. We put him into the truck that had taken us up to the 1500 weight truck that had taken us to the range, and drove back down to the camp. Of course, in camp it was a restricted 5 miles per hour, and the truck driver went through camp towards the medical centre at somewhere about 40 mile an hour, with the RSM waving his hands like no. Unfortunately, of course, the poor chap had died. But so that was my first instance, after only 4 weeks in the army, of what can happen. There's one little incident regarding our instructor's efforts for teamwork worth noting or mentioning. There was one young chap, only a 19-year-old, a solicitor's son, but he would not clean himself. He was never smart, both in his uniform or even his own personal cleanliness. He did always look dirty, and we knew at that time he did not wash. He was picked up, of course, by the drill sergeant many, many times over this, till it came to the point of he told four of us who were rather the older type of I suppose physically larger than this young lad. He said, "I shall be orderly sergeant this evening, and you four will get hold of Trooper ABC. And you'll take him to the ablutions. You will strip him, and there you will wash him in sand and soap. The sand, of course, from the fire buckets." He said, "I shall be in the ablutions, but near the ablutions, to see you are not interfered with." Needless to say, by the time the four of us had scrubbed this chappie with sand and soap, he did shone like a new pin, and it actually did the trick. He never, he always looked clean from then on. After that 6 weeks break, basic training, of course it was passing out parade and then home as quick as we could get for 7 days leave. Reporting back then to find that we'd been sorted out as to what our future was to be. I was fortunately selected to be a driver mechanics course. I did not want to go on the wireless operators. I did not like did. So that was my job for the next 12 weeks, learning all about engines and driving everything from, say, first of all, Bren gun carriers, and then Mark IV light tanks, I believe, and then going up, working up onto Valentine's, Matilda's, and learning then all about the Churchill, which was the main equipment at that particular time. We were very pleased with the Churchill to think that we had 6 inches of armour plate in front of us at the driving end, but only about 2 inches on the side. But even so, later on we found that whatever armour was no good against the German 88. End of training, passed out, driver mechanic grade 1, extra threats on our 1 and 6 pence per day pay. And so another fortnight's leave, embarkation leave. Returning not to that camp, but to the 57th Training Regiment at Buffington in Dorset for, eventually embarkation, which came about then in Cuba. We went to Avonmouth, boarded a ship, the Arawa, which was a shore Savile Line boat, normally on a refrigerator meat run from New Zealand to England. Normally, but of course, converted into a tube carrier, on which eventually there were 3,500 troops on board. We sailed 23rd of October out of Avonmouth, picked up more boats out of Liverpool, farther on up the Irish Sea, and more boats joined us out of Clyde. So it was quite a big convoy, and quite a number of escort vessels, cruisers, frigates, destroyers, and eventually even two merchant cruisers, the Monarch of Bermuda and the Queen of Bermuda. They were didn't join us until later on. We sailed northwards as if we were going to Iceland, and then in very, very heavy weather sailed down the middle of the Atlantic and eventually, after several weeks, came into the warmer climes. There was no celebrations of crossing the line, which was the first for many of us, first time for many of us. Then we pulled into a place called Bahia in Brazil for supplies, water in particular. 3,500 troops on board a ship use a lot of water, or drink a lot. The normal route was down the coast of Africa and calling at Freetown, but at that particular time I believe there was quite an array of submarines waiting at Freetown for troop carriers and so on, so we were diverted that way. After 3 or 4 days at Bahia, by the way, was brilliantly lit up at night time, which was the first time we'd seen a town lit up, well, since 1939, at least 2 to 3 years. From Bahia, we sailed south down the Atlantic and then turned eastwards and came along by Tristan da Cunha, the loneliest island in the world apparently, and then so on round and northwards up to first thing we saw land was Table Mountain, South Africa. We did not stay at Cape Town, we went round the corner and pulled into Durban with the what was a usual thing, and a well-known opera singer standing on the quay singing Land of Hope and Glory, which was the normal greeting for by this lady of all the convoys that came into Durban. I was very lucky in that no sooner we were free to go ashore, stretch our legs for the first time for 2 months, 8 weeks, other than doing physical exercises on the boat, I went to Fort Dunlop. I asked them where Fort Dunlop was, and they told me, and I went there because a friend of mine from Birmingham had gone out in 1934 to start with several chaps to start Dunlop Rubber Company in South Africa. Now I was shown straight to his office and spent some happy times in the being shown around Durban by him and his wife, and of course seeing his two daughters again, who I knew also very well. The people generally in Durban were very, very hospitable, and the food in places like the Jewish Club for 1 and 6 pence, bacon, egg and ham for 1 and 6 pence, mugs of tea, bread and butter, was absolute delight after the very, 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 very poor food we'd had on the ship. While at Durban, I was able to write a letter, an aircraft, or airmail, whatever they were called, to my wife, and I was able to say I had met and I was with Arthur Hughes. Of course, we were not able to say where we were, but my wife soon picked that up to the effect that I was there in Durban. This aircraft she did receive on Christmas morning, which started her Christmas off very, very well. 10 very happy days in Durham, and then up to Aden. We stayed one day at Aden there again for water, and so on up to Port Tewfik, where we disembarked and caught trains to Cairo. Well, those of us who were going to the RAC depot, the infantry people, I don't know anything about, but we went to Abbasir Barracks in Cairo, where after a few days we were sorted out, and quite a number of us who were in the original squad at Warminster, we were posted to the 3rd County of London Yeomanry, the sharpshooters, who were a tank regiment and had been part of the, a rare part of the 7th Armoured Div, had been out there fighting all the major battles since early 1941. They had been pulled back in after Alamein, and we're being reinforced by people like myself and the other people from our convoy. Bad food, the desert with its openness was quite a contrast. The food on the ship was, in the latter stages, very, very bad. In fact, the potatoes were always black, and anything with wheat, such as porridge, things like that, and bread, absolutely full black with insects, so much so that on one occasion everyone on the mess deck refused to eat their meal. I showed the orderly officer, because when during his tour of duty he immediately stopped everything, and in a very short time the whole conglomeration of staff appeared and saw what we were being forced to eat and had refused to eat. Things did improve a little bit after that. Then again, when in our attempted accommodation in the desert, the cooks had every chance because they had got the equipment. But there again, the main thing was bully beef in its various forms, boiled, fried, stewed, mashed bully beef. There again, the big problem was mornings, okay, there was possibly bacon and egg on the odd occasion. The shite hawks, they would fly down and make a grab for anything that was loose on a mess tin. Whereas in England, we, in our training, always been trained on English tanks, the latest of course being the Churchill, and the regiment, even in the desert, were always handicapped in that they were using English tanks, of course, with no more than the, what I would refer to the pea shooter, the two pounder, as against the German 75 and 88 mil. By the time we had got out to Egypt and the regiment pulled back from the desert, from Alamein, new tanks were arriving from America. The first few were good with the grounds, which were very, very limited, and then we were totally re-equipped with Shermans, with the 75mm gun on. Everything, all our training and everything had to be started all over again, the whole regiment using the new American Sherman tank. In those early months of 1943, it was a case of training with the new tanks, and also with the possibility of an invasion into Europe somewhere, where we did not know, but obviously it was going to come from the sea. And one or two invasion exercises were held in the Gulf of Cabrit. Very, very hot. When I say hot, we used to say it was 110 in the shade, but there ain't no shade. Landings and all those sort of things were rehearsed for the benefit of Lord Mountbatten, who came out there to watch what was going on, not knowing, we ourselves not knowing where would we be in Europe, but always interested, of course. In between training, exercises and all this, and we were able to make a few calls into Cairo and places of interest, say Memphis, Luxor, just the odd day out in 1500 white trucks. So we've got an end, of course. Eventually, the pyramids. We did get to the pyramids on one occasion, myself and two pals, very late evening. We climbed about two-thirds the way up, the 480 feet off the Great Pyramid, but the sun was going down. As there is no twilight, the sun disappearing very, very quickly, we thought it best to scamper down the 3 foot 6 cube blocks of stone quickly and get down back down to normal sand. Before leaving the desert scene, I feel I must tell you about a particular character. The regiment, or even a squadron, or a troop, is composed of all types of chaps. But this one particular person, Trooper Tinson, he was quite a character and frequently caused a smile on our faces. I'll relate just, I think, three particular instances that caused amusement. Whenever we could, we took advantage of a swim. Now, Tinson, he was quite a good swimmer. On one occasion, it was noticed that Tinson, he had been swimming, but no one could see him. Anyway, looking out and to the sea, it was noticed that there was a fin appearing at the water, and somebody, of course, shouted, shark,
shark. The tinson was missing. And lo and behold, eventually, tinson appeared swimming. Somehow or another, he'd contrived to fix a shark's fin to his body, and he was swimming underwater with only the shark's fin showing. So, of course, tinson himself appeared, it caused quite a bit of amusement. But